Okay, so now welcome back to Organizational Psychology. Today we will be talking about personality and values. And I hope Stefan Braun treated you well last week. I checked it out on video, so it seems that he did a good job. Let's see whether you remember the things he talked about. And let's briefly discuss the multiple choice items from last week's topic, where you discussed moods and emotions. Which of the following is a generic term that covers a broad range of feelings that people experience? Cognition, affect, moods, emotions, or emotional labor? Yes, please. It's B, affect. Affect is a broad generic term that covers both emotions and moods that people experience. Julia works as a receptionist in a real estate company. One morning, her boss comes in the door and yells at her, telling her that the front office is a mess and that she needs to get up and clean it immediately. After her boss leaves the room, Julia grabs three magazines and violently slams them into the trash can. Which of the following best describes Julia's anger? Mood, affect, emotion, mental process, or thought? Yes, Frau Doktor. It's an emotion. Emotions, as you heard last week, are specific, affect-based, and often action-oriented. On which of the following days do people tend to be in their best moods? Sundays, Saturdays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, or Mondays?
Saturday.
Thank you. Saturdays?
Yes.
Yes. Why is that?
Because they have a rest.
They have a rest, yeah. And they look forward to have another day of rest where they can lie in and do something exciting, yes.
Yes.
But on Sunday evenings, how does it look at Sunday evenings?
Negative.
Which of the where are the two emotions? Positive and negative. Are they
being Sunday evening?
No. Why is that?
Because next day they need to work.
Okay. But what is work such a bad thing? I enjoy working. I'm always in my worst mood on Friday evenings when I think, oh, another 2 days without any meaningful things to do. How is it in China? Studying, for example, do you regularly study on Saturdays, or is a study week organized as in Germany from Monday till Friday afternoon?
Yeah.
So you have Saturdays off. So in China, you are also in your best moods on Saturdays.
Yeah. Friday evening
it starts to be good.
Yes.
And Sunday it goes down again.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So it seems to be interculturally relatively stable that people's positive mood shows a positive development over the course of the week and people's negative mood shows a negative development over the week, so that our best moods are on Fridays and Saturdays, and our worst moods are on Sundays and Mondays. Today's, hello Fabian.
Hey.
Today is Wednesday, today is Thursday, and I think the positive mood is already slightly above the negative mood, which is good. So today we will be talking about personality and values, and I got some exercises for you and some questionnaires. And one thing I would like you to think about for a moment individually is about your job that you may have next to the university or that you did in the past. And think about one colleague, one individual you have problems working with, one individual you don't enjoy working with. And think about this person and how this person is. Or was, when you think about some work that you did in the past. Okay, everyone should have a name and a picture in your head about one individual that you didn't enjoy or don't enjoy working with. And now think about someone you do enjoy or did enjoy working with, you liked working with, you looked forward meeting him or her and sitting next to him in the office or doing some work with him or her. Think about this other individual. Okay? Then you have two individuals in your mind that you either like or don't like working with. Can you please describe these two individuals to the person next to you? Discuss for just 1 minute what this person looks like, how he or she is, etc. Okay, thank you very much. What you have probably done is that you used terms of personality research or personality concepts to describe this other individual to your partner. And we will discuss personality today, we will discuss values today. In particular, we will define personality, we will talk a little bit about the Myers-Briggs type indicator, because it's a very frequently used personality assessment tool that is used in practice. We will also talk about more scientifically based research tools like the Big Five model of personality. We will also talk about other personality traits apart from the Big Five factors. And then we discuss values, both in terms of value systems, value models, and cultural differences in values that people hold. So the personality or personality can be described as relatively enduring patterns of our behaviors, feelings, and thoughts, or as the sum total of ways in which an individual reacts to and interacts with others. And most often in our everyday language, we use measurable traits such as a person is shy or aggressive or submissive or lazy or ambitious. And those of you who have described a person you enjoyed working with in the past have probably used positive traits to describe this other person, such as someone who is loyal or who is positive or who is hardworking. Others may have used traits about the person you didn't enjoy with that are negative, like shy or aggressive or dominant, etc. How can we measure which personality people have? We can basically use two ways of surveys. The first one is self-reported surveys. These are most typically used, both in practice when we do personality assessments for making selection or promotion decisions, we use self-reported surveys in organizations, but also in research. Most of our research is using self-reported surveys. So we provide scales to people, and I have an example about a personality scale for you in a moment. We provide scales for people and then ask them to describe themselves on a number of items. This is easy to administer. This is cheap and less costly than other alternative methods, but of course they are prone to error. For some personality traits, you feel that it doesn't sound good to be too high or too low on this factor, and then you may deliberately make assessments that are underestimating or overestimating your true personality. And for other items, you may not really know what you are about, and unconsciously you may tick the wrong box. But by and large, self-report surveys, although they are prone to error, and social desirability is one factor that may cause these errors, by and large, self-reported surveys are also very useful and very informative, and many personality tests have been found to be valid. And I will talk about validity in a moment when we talk about the relationship between personality scores and performance, for example. And most of the research that has identified these validity scores has used self-reported surveys. We can, of course, also ask other people to describe the focal person. So when we assess people for making a promotion decision, who becomes a leader of a team, then I could ask the team members' colleagues to provide ratings. I can use independent assessments by one's partners or by one's supervisors. They may be more accurate, particularly on the negative dimensions, but as you can imagine, they are much more costly, much more difficult to administer, and there are sometimes also some ethical problems to consider. When I ask colleagues, for example, to provide ratings on a focal employee to make a promotion decision, then these colleagues may consciously or unconsciously bias their reflections because they don't trust this person or they don't want to be this person to promote it for whatever reason. Lorenzo Avanzi, who is ill at the moment and who was with me the last couple of weeks, he did a survey about people's identity and identification. As you know, this is my main research topic and also Lorenzo Avanzi's, and also about people's personality. And he also asked the employees' partners, spouses, to provide the same ratings about the focal person. And what we found is that identification, self-reported and other reported, is not related at all. There's no relationship. So it seems that my partner cannot really assess whether I feel proud to be a member of Goethe University, whether I feel personally embarrassed when Goethe University is criticized, etc. The correlation was about 0.5, 0.6, very, very low and not significant. Personality, however, personality scores correlated well between self-report and other reports. We found correlations in the mid or high 40s, 0.46, 0.47. So partners can accurately assess whether people are more extroverted or more introverted, etc. We will discuss these factors in a moment. Okay? So personality is the sum total of ways in which we react to or interact with others, or the relatively enduring patterns of our feelings, thoughts, and actions, and we as researchers or practitioners in organizations can measure personality using self-report or observer ratings. But where does personality come from? Why do people differ in the way they react to or interact with others? And there's a large discussion and also a large fundament on research evidence that heredity seems to play a major role. Particularly twin studies. You have heard about twin studies from individual differences psychology, and twin studies typically work the way that twins who were adopted after birth are compared with twins who live together in one family, and because twins share a lot of genetic material, any differences between twins can only be accounted for by the differences in how they were educated by their real parents or by their adoption parents. And typically these studies show that for most of the personality factors, heredity plays a large role. Some people say 60%, some people say it's 70%, but for most of the personality factors, independently of the exact share of genetics, it does matter and it does play a big role. However, environmental factors also have some influence. It does matter in which context, for example, we are. If we are a very shy person, for example, we are more shy than others across situations, but we are certainly less shy when we are with our friends on a leisure time event, in a cinema or in a pub, than when we are at a job interview. And those people who are not at all shy are less shy across situations, but even these people will be a little more different, behave a little more different in job interviews than when they are doing sports with their friends. So environmental factors do have an influence of how personality develops, but also how personality is translated into actions in the real context. Age influences the levels of ability, so it seems that older people, for example, are doing a little bit less well in some ability tests, particularly those that have speed components, whereas people's personality seems to stay relatively stable or relatively constant. Severe events like traumata or severe events like splitting up of a marriage or being fired or promoted at work can change our personality. So it's not the case that the personality develops at the age of 12, 13, or 14, and then it remains stable until we die. It can be altered by significant events in our environment. But more or less across people, personality is highly correlated across several measurement points in time, and some studies have used 10 or 20 year intervals between measurements. Okay. Now, when you end up as a manager in a human resource management department, you will find that the Myers-Briggs type indicator is one of the most frequently used personality assessment in organizational practice. Many big organizations use the Myers-Briggs inventory, such as Google and Apple and Lufthansa. I don't know, Frau Türktorun, do you know whether Lufthansa is still using it for recruitment? Do you know whether Lufthansa uses the Myers-Briggs inventory for recruitment decisions?
I'm not sure, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, probably they don't use it now or not anymore or only for specific. Or maybe they have produced a version of it that is based on the indicator. And because it's so frequently used, I think it's good that you have heard about it. The problem with, well, let me first explain it. It's a test where people answer items and then they are classified on four different dimensions, either as extroverted or introverted persons, as either sensing or intuitive. Sensors are practical, intuits are more using unconscious processes. Then they are classified along the dimension of being either thinking or feeling. Thinkers, as you can imagine, use reason and logic. Feeling utilizes emotions and values. And the final dimension is judging or perceiving. Judges want order and structure. Perceivers are more flexible and spontaneous. And according to these classifications on these four dimensions, there are 16 different personality types, and these are called INTJ or ESTJ, etc. And then you are an extrovert, intuit, thinking, and perceiver. And the problem is that there's no black and white. People are classified into categories, and you either fit into a category or you fit into the other category, but it's not possible to be somewhere in the middle, which many people, however, are, and which is possible on other instruments that I will discuss in a moment. So this is one problem, that it puts people into boxes and that it ignores that some people on at least some dimensions do not really fit into the either or of the instrument's design. And also the validity has been questioned, and the research evidence that is available has more or less not confirmed that there's any relationship with performance. So when you end up in organizations, you should know what it is. You should probably also acknowledge that organizations are difficult to change, and systems like this, because people like completing these questionnaires. It's like completing a Brigitte test. People like doing that and getting some knowledge about themselves, and it may raise their self-awareness. So it may not be a too bad thing if you realize that you are more on the intuitive side rather than on the rational, cognitive, logical side. This may tell you something about it, but it's not related to performance, and therefore managers should not use this instrument to make important decisions about selection or promotion, etc. This is at least what the research agrees about, but you will find in organizational practice that many instruments are used without any research evidence or maybe even negative research evidence, but people stick to it because organizations have always done it this way, and when you criticize it, you will probably criticize someone who has brought this instrument into practice 10 years ago and who is now a senior manager, so it's very difficult to change the system. And when you know that people will use it, then you should at least know what it is good for and what it is not good for. And my suggestion is, if you ever are on a level that you can make own decisions, then do not use these instruments for making promotion or selection decisions, but you may still use it in development trainings for raising people's self-awareness. Yes, please. I completely agree, but there are better instruments for this. And one instrument, for example, are instruments based on the Big Five personality inventory. And before I discuss this, I would give you the opportunity to learn more about yourself by completing a very brief version of the Big Five personality inventory. So here you can assess your basic personality on the Big Five dimensions. Very rough instrument or very crude instrument. So complete the 15 items and say whether you are either quiet or talkative, etc. And then on the second page you find some cutoff values and some ways to interpret your results. Okay. Most of you seem to be done, and maybe you can also check it out in more detail back at home. What you have just completed is the Brigitte test version of the Big Five personality model inventory. And as many of you know from test theory or individual differences or diagnostics, is that there are far more elaborate instruments available, like the 16PF or the MRI that comprise hundreds of items. And here you only have a selection of 15 items, that is three items for each of the main dimensions, which are the big branches of our personality. And we have hundreds, if not a thousand, studies that have confirmed that this is the basis of everyone's personality, relatively stable across cultures, ages, countries, etc. And these are, and you can memorize them by the acronym OCEAN: openness to experience, conscientiousness, extraversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And because it may sound better, some instruments turn neuroticism around, as was the case in this inventory, and call it emotional stability. Now, let's particularly look at the last factor, neuroticism. Doesn't sound good, or? Do you want to be a neurotic? Do you want to be seen or called a neurotic? Do you want to feel and see yourself as someone who is tense, insecure, and depressed? Probably not. But think about why there's still neuroticism in our world. Why are we still neurotic, or some of us are more neurotic than others? Because it was useful. Since the last 100,000, 200,000 years of evolution, there might be a reason why the trait of neuroticism has survived. Back on the savannah 200,000 years, those who were highly open to experience, they liked the flowers and admired the colors they saw. Those people got eaten by the tiger, by the wild animal. The neurotics in these times were the ones that said, there might be a wild animal, let's better stick together. There might be some bad weather coming, so let's better go back into our caves and take the fire with us, etc. And these people are desperately needed in today's organizations as well. Those are the people, and you may have one neurotic person in your little group of students you study with, or you learn for exams with, or you did a report with. The more neurotic persons are the ones that remind the others of the deadline, for example. So neuroticism is still a good trait that is helpful in some contexts or in some situations. So being a little bit neurotic may actually be helpful. Or having one little bit more neurotic person on your team may help the team perform better. Openness to experience sounds much better. Of course, we all want to be open to experience. We all want to be flexible and tolerant and these things. But do I really want to be a highly open to experience person when I work in a nuclear power plant? Do you want to have a person who presses a button just to see what happens, or to let the red light flash and see how long it goes? No, probably not. You want to have a person who is extremely conscientious and follows the rules and is extremely punctual and looks at the instruments and at the first sign of any problem does what he is required to do or she is required to do. And openness to experience is probably not so good in this context. Openness to experience, however, is needed when you work in a research and development context, when you work in a design or marketing organization. So what I want to say is that neither of these five big personality factors are good or bad. Some of them are better in some situations, some of them are better in other situations, and other or different from the Myers-Briggs type inventory, here you have a score about whether you score on the introvert or extrovert end of the continuum, and it's allowed to score in the middle. You are not put in the box and you are told you are completely not open to experience, you are completely not agreeable or agreeable. Many of us, for some traits, many of us score somewhere in the middle of these two dimensions. For other personality variables, however, you are on some more extremes of the continuum, and these are the personality scores that are probably most important to you and describe you best. And back to your question, whether we can use the Myers-Briggs type inventory, I think there are better instruments available, like instruments based on the Big Five inventory, that also help people to get to know themselves a little better and to know whether they are, for example, open to experience and highly extroverted, and then they are better suited to do jobs in sales, or whether they are low on these factors and better go into finances. Or if you are high on conscientiousness and a job in controlling may be particularly good for you. If you are not at all conscientious, then a job in controlling or finances may suit you less well. Overall, research has strongly supported relationships with the Big Five factors and job performance, particularly with conscientiousness. Conscientiousness seems to be the factor that is most closely related to performance across professions or occupational groups. For other variables, it depends on what we are looking for or in which context we look for it. Extraversion, for example, has been found to be positively related to performance in sales contexts, but not in many other contexts. Now, this is another way of sorting the Big Five factors, and these are the main characteristics that describe the broad Big Five factors. And what I would like you to do now for 1 or 2 minutes is go back to the examples from the beginning. Think about the person you enjoyed working with or the person you did not enjoy working with. And describe to your partner whether or not this other person is similar or dissimilar from your own personality. Okay? Maybe not on all five dimensions, but maybe you know now which of the five dimensions are maybe particularly important to you, and describe this other person you enjoyed working with or not enjoyed working with on this dimension. Okay, thank you very much. Can you probably give us one or two examples of how you describe the person that you enjoyed working with? Did you describe this other person as more different or more similar from you on the traits that are important to you? Yes, please.
The person I enjoyed to work with was very similar to me. Mm-hmm. And the other person was very different. And the other person was very I think that this person would score in every five factors very high. And this was not good.
Okay. So, but this also means that this person was similar to you on the dimensions that you also score high, but dissimilar to you on other dimensions where you didn't score so high. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, please.
The person I most enjoyed working with was very similar to myself in the on skates for conceptualism, and because of the work environment, this was very important for me to have somebody I can rely on. Mm-hmm.
And the person you didn't enjoy working with so much?
Was similar to me, for example, on skates for extroversion, but dissimilar on conceptualism.
Okay, thank you. Research overall has confirmed that we like people who are similar to us. So similarities attract each other, fits research evidence much more than the saying that we have, at least in Germany, that contrasts attract each other or people who are contrary to each other. So similarity is what we typically look for. And yes, it sometimes can be that we constantly clash with someone because he is exactly the same on some dimensions. When you are extremely high on conscientiousness, then sometimes it may be good to have someone who is a little bit less conscientious. But more often than not, it's good when two conscientious people work together, whereas when one person is conscientious and the other is not, they will clash. And this is what we typically find. We prefer to be with people who tick like we do. And in 3 weeks or so, when we talk about leadership, we will talk about a concept that is called LMX, Leader Member Exchange Theory, and that is about forming relationships to some people we lead better, that are better than relationships with other people we lead. And one basis of this distinction between being in the inner circle and having a positive relationship to my boss, or not being in this inner circle and having a less good relationship to my boss, is that we either have different or similar personalities. And the problem here is that sometimes leaders do not acknowledge or do not realize that they assess people wrongly just on the basis that they have a different personality, although they should objectively refer to or rate people based on their performance and not their personality and whether it's similar to their own personality or not. Particularly, given what I said initially, that it's good maybe to have some people in the team who are a little more diverse, and if the team as a whole is less neurotic or more emotionally stable, this is certainly sensible and good for the team's performance, but having one or two team members who are a little bit more neurotic may also be helpful for the team as a whole. And therefore, as leaders, we should try to realize that sometimes we punish people for being different from us, although this may not completely not be justified in terms of their objective performance. This is a summary again of how the big five factors relate to outcomes. So conscientiousness, as I said, typically to higher satisfaction, lower stress, emotional stability to higher performance. Leaders are typically a little bit more emotionally stable, typically also more job and life satisfaction. Extraversion leads to better performance in trainings. They are more adaptable to change. Agreeable people are higher on performance and show lower levels of deviant behavior. Last time we discussed deviance and there was someone stealing pens from her organization. Where is she?
Oh.
So probably it was not good that we filmed it. But anyway, so less deviant behavior among people who are high on agreeableness, and people who are openness also by and large show higher performance and are better leaders or are more successful in attaining leadership positions. And people who are open to experience live longer. Research shows that these people live longer who stay open to experience and are flexible and tolerant of change. Together with Christian Stierle, I did some research more than 10 years ago with managers from a big German organization in the automotive industry, mostly engineers. I think all of the 126 managers that we surveyed were male. And these were managers who were working on expatriate assignments in foreign countries. It was all German male managers, mostly engineers, and they worked in more than 40 countries, most of them in the US, Japan, France, and Brazil, some of them, however, also in China, Korea, and Spain. We measured their Big Five personality, and we used the NeoPI inventory from Ostenhof and Angleiter, which has 240 items. So you see that measuring personality accurately takes a lot more than just 15 adjectives or 15 items. So we use 240 items to measure personality. We measured people's performance by asking them about a self-report assessment of their performance on the dimensions that the organizations also used for supervisor assessed performance ratings, efficiency, effectiveness, reaching their goals, and creativity, innovation. For half of the sample, we also had supervisor ratings available, and the correlation between self-report and supervisor reported performance was 0.41. So it's a validity indicator that suggests self-reported performance seems to have something to do with what the supervisors also would evaluate. We measured people's job satisfaction, and we measured people's intercultural adjustments, so how well they were adjusted to the foreign culture and the foreign assignment. Many, many foreign assignments are terminated prematurely. So people are sent on a two-year assignment to some of these countries, and then they return after 6 months because they don't fit into the foreign culture, they don't like it there, they have problems adjusting and accommodating. And this is extremely costly. This is costly for the individual because typically this also goes together with 6 months of ill health and dissatisfaction. It's also costly for the individual psychologically to return to your home country and having to admit that you are not able to make it into a foreign country. It's also costly in terms of money because these people are often trained to go onto the foreign assignment. They get language courses and these sorts of things. And also it disrupts the organization's processes because they have to find someone new for the foreign position and the position on which the returning manager wants to get back is often already filled by someone else. So it causes a lot of problems. Some estimates say it's about 100,000 to 150,000 euro, 150,000 euro per early terminated foreign assignment. So we wanted to know the contribution of the Big Five personality factors to the outcomes of performance, job satisfaction, and intercultural assignment. And I'll provide you a few, or just an overview. These are the Big Five factors: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And you see we have negative correlations that were significant to all three dimensions. Those who were more neurotic as foreign managers abroad showed lower job performance, were less satisfied, and found it less easy to adjust to the foreign culture. So this means neuroticism is certainly not a factor you should score too high on when you want to do a foreign assignment in a different country. There are many zeros, so many of these factors are not related to our dimensions. Agreeableness, for example, seems not to be related to any of these dimensions. Conscientiousness, for some reason I cannot explain here in this context, it's not related to performance, but was related to job satisfaction. Openness was related to performance. Extroversion was related to performance and intercultural adjustment. So by and large, it seems that in this context, agreeableness does not matter. Conscientiousness matters a little, at least for job satisfaction. Openness seems to matter for performance. Extroversion seems to be a good variable to focus on, and neuroticism as well, but of course in the other direction. When we presented this to the senior management of this organization, they told us, oh, that's all very interesting. However, what can we do with it? Because so often we don't announce a position for 2 years in Washington or Paris, where we certainly would get some applications, but we need to send an engineer to Vladivostok for 2 years. And then we are extremely happy when there's one person saying, okay, I would do that if you pay me a lot. But when we would do selection tests like this, we would never find someone who is able to go. And I'm not so sure whether this is the best answer of the organization. Because, as I said earlier, it's extremely costly to send someone abroad and then having him or her return after a couple of months or half or a year maybe. So it may be better to design the jobs better and have more applicants, maybe pay them even more so that you have a pool of applicants you select for, and then it's better to use these tests and, for example, to filter those people who are lowest on neuroticism and send them to the foreign assignment than to have some people who return early with the problems for everyone involved. Okay. So this is the big five personality, and the big branches of our personality make up. There are, of course, also other personality traits. In the recent, I would say 10 years, core self-evaluations is becoming more and more a dimension in organizational and management research that has been looked at, because it's pretty strongly correlated to job satisfaction and performance. And core self-evaluations comprise four dimensions. It's high self-esteem. People who are high on core self-evaluations have a positive feeling about themselves, high self-esteem. Low neuroticism. High generalized self-efficacy. They feel that they are competent and able to overcome problems. And they have an internal locus of control. So they feel that they are responsible for what happens and not that they are victims of fate and other people. So core self-evaluation seems to be a personality dimension that is relevant both for satisfaction and for performance. And Tim Judge, the author of our textbook, is also one of the founders of this concept, and he has provided scales that are available in English and in many other languages. And among them also short scales with just 12 items where you can measure all four dimensions relatively reliable and valid. Yes, please.
What was the third dimension you mentioned? Is it high self-esteem, low neuroticism, and the fourth one was internal local control?
Generalized self-efficacy, high self-efficacy. Machiavellism. You know Machiavelli, the Italian writer who is often seen as someone who has suggested that power is good and that people should do all they can to get into power and then use their power to pursue their own interests. I think if you read Machiavelli a little bit more closer, he also said many other things, so it's probably not so negative as it seems. But people who are high on Machiavellianism tend to be pragmatic. They tend to believe that the end justifies the means, and they are often emotionally distant from other people. Sometimes they can be good performers, and sometimes having people who are a little bit high on Machiavellianism may be good for your team and the organization, because these people will also know where to get the important resources from and so on. But as you can imagine, believing that the end satisfies or justifies the means is often also causing problems because it may lead to making unethical decisions, and being emotionally distant seems not to be nice when you work in teams and with other people. Leaders, however, are often a little higher on Machiavellianism. Narcissism also does not sound too good. These are people who have a grandiose view of themselves. They require excessive admiration. That's why I always ask you for feedback and regularly ask you to give me good feedback. I'm maybe a little higher on narcissism than other people. I have a big sense of self-entitlement, and maybe I'm a little arrogant, which is okay. I'm better than you. Yeah. Not related to job performance. So being a narcissist may feel good, but it's not so good. Other factors, self-monitoring. People who are high on self-monitoring constantly observe how they appear in other people or on other people, and they try to adjust this to meet what they think the situation requires and what other people would like them to be, would like them to do. This can be very adaptive. This can be functional. This can be good. Risk-taking is a personality factor where people differ on. We have scales, for example, on sensation-seeking, and some people are high on sensation-seeking, other people are low on sensation-seeking. And probably brokers are a little bit higher on risk-taking, and this is probably overall not a too bad a trend to have, but as we have seen in 2008, it also can lead into extreme disasters when you have too many people who are all very similar on one dimension, such as risk-taking in one industry or one organization. Type A personality, maybe you have heard this in clinical psychology or individual differences. It's a concept of the 1960s where two researchers have looked at people suffering from heart diseases and strokes, and they have found that they have classified people into type A and type B personalities, and type A personalities are a little bit more at risk, or much more at risk, to suffer from heart diseases. They are always very competitive, very driven, everything is very urgent. They juggle several projects at the same time, and they do it in a very competitive style. They want to do the best in every project, they want to be better than others, etc. This seems to be not so good a trait. It may make you relatively successful in the organization, so you may climb the ladder and earn more money and get into leadership positions, but it's clearly also related to ill health. Do you know whether it's still a topic in clinical psychology? I'm also not sure whether it has been followed up and whether there's more research. I'm aware of the research by Rosenman in the 1960s, 67, 69. They have found clear evidence for this relationship between type A personality and heart diseases, and type B people seem to be a little bit more at risk to suffer from depression, for example. Yes, please. Oh, that I don't know. Maybe cancer, but I don't know. I know about depression and type B personality, and I know about heart diseases and type A. I don't know about cancer. Proactive personality is something that was invented by Michael Frese, a colleague who was a professor at Gießen University for a long time and is now working at Singapore University. People who have a proactive personality identify opportunity, they show initiative and take action and persevere in case of problems. And proactive personalities seem to be much more successful in organizations, be higher on performance, and be good for the organization. So it's good to select people who have a higher proactive personality because they will also act more proactively by taking initiatives, making suggestions, being more innovative, etc. Okay, so this is personality. And now you've been reminded of many things that you have heard about already in individual differences psychology. You may have learned something new, but it's good to keep in mind that personality is an important concept for organizational behavior, because people's personality drives their behavior, and some of this is related to their performance, some of it is related to their job satisfaction. So it's good to consider personality when we talk about how we design a team, how we put together groups and organizations, who we select for certain jobs, etc. Another important concept is values. Values represent basic enduring convictions that a specific mode of conduct or end state of existence is preferable, either personally or socially, to an opposite or converse mode of conduct or a different end state of existence. We can call our preferences, that a specific mode of conduct or end state of existence is preferable. We can call these ideal values, where we strive for, where we orient ourselves on in what we think and do. And we can call the opposite or converse mode of conduct or end state of existence our counter-ideal values. Together with some researchers, Nils van Kwakebeke from Hamburg and Rudi Kerschreiter from Berlin University, we have recently published a paper which gives an overview about ideal and counter-ideal value research in psychology in general. We have many streams in psychology where we think about in these dual modes of thinking and information processing, and we believe that ideal and counter-ideal values are relevant for the workplace. And I'll show you one example of our own research in a moment. Value systems, so whole systems of different value, represent a prioritizing of individual values. So individuals can hold different value systems when you look not at their own, their individual values, but at their values as a system as a whole. And then individuals differ in which values they find most important. This is content. And how intense do they hold these values? So some of you may hold one value very strongly, and this value is very important to you. Others have a set of three or four values that are similarly important for you, and you can imagine that the intensity you hold each of these four values can only be a little bit less intense than a person who only has one or two values he or she orients themselves. So this is one way of designing value system, identifying the important ones and then measuring the relative importance of these to other values that are not so important. The hierarchy of these values seem to be relatively stable once we have assumed this value system. Maybe at the age of 15, 16, 18, they seem to be relatively constant, and they drive our attitudes, motivation, and ultimately our behavior. And they influence our perception and sometimes cloud our objectivity. I give you a few examples of values in a moment, but you can easily imagine when your number one value is living a prosperous life and making a lot of money, then your perceptions are influenced by this, on what you perceive is good and right, and your objectivity may also be clouded. This may have led to the scandals of Enron or other ethical misconducts that we have seen in the past, that people were so driven by their values to make a lot of money that they have perceived reality not very objectively and therefore did the wrong things. Milton Rokic in the 1960s developed the Rokic Value Survey that is still used, and he differentiated between two broad categories: terminal values and instrumental values. Terminal values refer to desirable end states of existence. Instrumental values refer to preferred modes of behavior. to achieve these terminal values. And here are some examples. This list is not exclusive, but these are probably the most prominent terminal values that people can hold. Living a comfortable life, living an exciting life, getting a sense of accomplishment, making a lasting contribution to society or to the groups we are members of. A world of peace could be one terminal value that some of us hold very strongly and strive for. Family security may be one value. And again, when you think about value systems, some of us just hold one or two of these terminal values very strongly. Others probably go for three or four or five of these values. And then they are also important for you, but each of them is probably held a little bit less intensely than if you would only have one terminal value or two terminal values. And these are examples of instrumental values, so those values that help us achieving our terminal values. When we want to have a comfortable, prosperous life, and this is our most important number one value, then probably we have also the instrumental values of working hard and being aspiring. Maybe capability is important, maybe courage is important. So some of these instrumental values are related to the terminal values and they go together. But according to Rokic, we can distinguish between these two categories or classes. And if you go back to what we discussed a minute ago, Machiavellianism, Machiavellists think that the means satisfy the ends. So if I want to live a prosperous life and if this is my dominating value, then I can do whatever I want. The most important thing is to achieve this value. And now I would like to do another little exercise with you. It's an ethical dilemma about personal values and ethics in the workplace. I would like you to read the text and then in groups of three or four, discuss what you would do if you were CIFO. Would you have acted the way he acted, and can you understand the organization or not? Okay? So maybe it takes you 3 or 4 minutes to read the text, and then I think we should take 5 minutes for you to discuss what you have read. In groups of maybe 4 or 5, so maybe those 4 or 5 can go together, and maybe you can turn around and discuss with the others, and then maybe you can form 2 groups.
Ich höre nur zu.
Von der Geschichte her, aber wenn sie jetzt jeden entlassen, der irgendwie ja, zu tun hat, dann muss man einfach Drucks irgendwie. Ja. Wir würden wieder auf der Grundposition einstellen, kann den Fehler wieder äußern.
Nach seinem Wertesystem vielleicht erkannt, weil das Wertesystem in der Gesellschaft.
Familie höher war als Ehrlichkeit.
Für ihn schon, würde ich sagen. Aber für seine Community nicht. Ja, ich denke. Ja, ich meine, wenn man in seiner Situation ist, hat man sich den Wehren können. Also, ich würde es immer nicht ja, genau. Aber muss sagen,
ja, ich meine, problematisch ist halt auch noch diese Vorarbeit, dass er ihn im Verband und ich denke, deswegen fällt auch schon mal weg, dass er ihn anklagt, wenn ihm das so wichtig ist. Also mein so ein gutes Family Member kann das echt.
Ja, aber wenn er denkt, das fällt nicht auf, dann will er ja eigentlich auch nur das Beste für okay, sich und ja.
Jetzt bleibt in der Familie.
Jedenfalls nicht so einfach. Okay, thank you very much for the discussion. I know it's not so easy. And value systems help ourselves making decisions that are at least based on what we over time feel is right and good, irrespectively of the outcome. And if family values are most important to Sefold, yeah, then maybe the outcome in the end was not good for him, but his high family value system will also help him cope with the problem because his family, the extended family may have similar values and is supportive of him, etc. I was reminded on an incident some 20 years ago when I was in Cairo. On my way back from Bombay to Frankfurt, I flew via Cairo and had 10 hours stay in Cairo. So I thought it might be a good idea to see the pyramids. I wanted to get a one-day visa and entered the respective counter. And then this person at the other end said, yes, but we need a document of health, a special document. And I said, oh, I don't have this document. And then he was poking me in my hand and was twinking. And so I understood the message and put $10 into my passport, gave it back to him. And then he said, that's the important document of health and you're allowed to stay within our country for 24 hours. Welcome. And I just realized, yeah, it was bribing this person. It was bribery. We discussed, or you briefly discussed, whether a bribe is from which side needs to be bribed and who is responsible. But that's not so important. If I'm asked to give money for something I shouldn't give money to, then I'm the one who is doing the bribing or the bribery. And maybe by doing that, I uphold a system that is not in accord with my values. Maybe at that time I should have said no, thank you, then I'd rather stay in your beautiful airport. And what is important is value systems, not only to people but also to organizations. Heraeus in Hanau is a big global company that deals with gold and other metals and produces dental tools, etc. And they have a clear value system that wherever they do business, they don't accept corruption. Corruption is not tolerated. And they still do business in countries where you would normally say that you need some bribery and some of it may be okay, and rather than losing business and jobs and so on, it may be okay. When you have this clear value system, that provides order for everyone working in this organization, and it may help, depending on what value system that is. So I'm saying, if Sifo has this value system that family is most important, then it may be okay to act the way he acted. If someone else would have a different value system, they would have to act differently, irrespective of the outcome in the end. Yes, please. It's a tricky question, and I'm sure at Heraeus, in practice, if you are a worker and a local worker, for example, in a different country than Europe or Germany, it may be difficult, it may be tricky. But then you at least know the organization's rules, and you can turn to your supervisor or to the next higher supervisor, and they should give you proper advice based on the value system and not on their own system that may or may not be.
How easy is it to get up to that point of status where we can go to different countries and cooperate with them, sticking to your values?
Okay.
How often do you have to bend your personal lines?
That's right. It certainly matters. I mean, you can more easily afford to have a value system that is different from the country you do business in when you are in a position of power, when you do something that they cannot do on their own, or when there are not many competitors that may have very different value system, that certainly matters and plays a role. Yeah. Okay, let me quickly go through some of the remaining slides. As one example of why ideal and counter-ideal values matter, Niels van Kwakebeek and we did several studies now where we show that both are important, and we focused in one paper on how much we like our leader and how much we identify our leader. Our reasoning is that ideal values provide orientation. So when you are a boat on a big sea, in the big sea, and there's darkness around you, then the lighthouse provides orientation. But we say that in addition to the lighthouse, we know we should aim for, our counter-ideal values provide another point of orientation that helps us sailing the sea particularly well. Here we are. And what we found when we ask employees about both whether their leaders fit their ideals and do not fit their counter-ideals, then we are much better able to predict whether they are satisfied with their leaders and whether they can identify with their leaders. You see that the values and the counter-ideal values both contribute to identification and satisfaction on about the same level. So knowing where we do not want to go is very important. And from the value systems, you know, these are not necessarily counter-ideal values that are negative, like we do not accept corruption. This can be a counter-ideal value, but it's just one example of a counter-ideal value. It can only also be that some people hold counter-ideal values that are positive and ideal values to others. And both together provide us with orientation. Very quickly or briefly, okay, I try to do it this way then. John Hogan developed the vocational preference inventory questionnaire that helps people with thinking about which organization, which profession to choose. He also puts people into categories, and it has been found that it is helpful, that it helps people finding the right profession. However, most research has been done on not person job fit, but person organization fit. And it seems that it is more important that the personalities and values of the employees fit the organization's culture more than a specific job within the organization. Because fit between personality of individual and culture of the organization predicts job satisfaction, organizational commitment, people's turnover. And we did a study with Johannes Ulrich and others where we surveyed about 3,000 members of political parties in Germany a couple of years ago. And it was largely representative for the different parties. And in that survey, we used two items to measure person-party fit by asking them about their own political orientation from very left to far right and the orientation of their party from left to right. And we asked them about identification. To what extent do they identify with the organization? We covered that a couple of times already. But also disidentification. To what extent do I not identify with my organization? Neutral identification, I'm not sure, I'm not attracted to it. And ambivalent identification, I feel conflicted about. I have contradictory feelings. And then we did polynomial regression analysis, and what we found was that for identification, fit or misfit between one's own orientation and the party's orientation didn't matter. So if you are a member of the Social Democratic Party in Germany, you may perceive that the party moved a little bit away from your own orientation, but that doesn't matter for identification. So we think that identification is a stable attitude that once developed will not change so much. However, it's very different for disidentification. Here we can explain additional variants. Particularly for identification, we can explain 3% of variants only. For this identification, we can explain 19% of variation. So when people's orientation is very right and the party's orientation is also very right, people disidentify least. When one's own orientation is -4, that means very left, but the organization's orientation is very right, then disidentification is greatest, and vice versa. And the same applies to ambivalent identification. Here we can explain 14% of the variation. And again, when there's misfit, then people show the greatest signs of ambivalent identification. So whether we fit the organization with our personality and our values does matter. If you hold green, peace-related values, you should probably not work in a company that is producing landmines. Although you may be well paid, you have a good supervisor and nice colleagues, you may have trouble identifying with this organization, and this causes problems for your job satisfaction and ultimately also for commitment and performance. Very quickly, just two slides. In addition to differences in organizational culture, and we discussed this in lecture 12 or 13, we also see differences in national cultures between countries. And the first big model that has been developed was the Hofstede model. Hofstede did his research at IBM in the 1960s. I think he surveyed some 50,000 IBM employees. And the good thing was that because it was the same organization across all 40-plus countries that he examined or investigated, he kept the organizational culture relatively stable, and the differences he found were due to the differences in national culture. And you have heard about, I think, most of these dimensions in some or other context. Power distance: do countries accept that some people are at the top and have a lot of power and others are at the bottom, or are countries more or less tolerant for high power distance? Are people individualized and do they want to stick out with their own strengths and weaknesses, or do they perceive themselves first and foremost as group and family members? Masculinity versus femininity is a big dimension. Uncertainty avoidance: do people want stability and certainty, or can they tolerate some uncertainty? And which orientation do they have, long-term or short-term? And this has been found very useful, but in the late 1990s, the Globe Leadership Study started with hundreds of researchers across the globe, and they surveyed about 15,000 managers in 800 organizations in 63 countries. And they found that some factors, some variables, were important across the globe that made leaders effective in the view of their employees. Other factors were culture specific. And because of the computer problems, I forgot to mention one thing that I would very briefly like to mention: the person organization fit. Ben Schneider, who is an influential writer in human resource management, he in the 1990s developed the ASA framework. Attraction: organizations attract the people that fit the organization's culture. So when you are Harley Davidson or Apple, then you have a certain culture that is also portrayed to the outside world, and university students who complete their programs are attracted to companies that they think fit their own values and personalities. In the selection process, those people will be identified by the selection methods, interviews, tests, etc., that fit the organization's culture even more. And over time, organizations become more and more homogeneous in their culture because of the attraction and selection, but also attrition. Because it may still be that the wrong people may be attracted and that they still pass the selection process, but they will leave the organization at some stage. And this makes organizations becoming more and more homogeneous. And I was telling this a group of people who were working in the building and construction industry in England some time ago, and they told me, yes, we know this framework for a long time. We call it FIFO framework, which means fit in or fuck off. And that should be it for today. Thank you very much. See you next week. Oh, I have some homework for you. We put this text on the webpage. It's about lessons from the Everest, a disaster that happened at the Everest some 15 years ago. That's a very interesting description of what happened and how psychological factor contributed to it. And I would like you to have a read through this until next week. Thank you.